I am not afraid of my opinion being challenged.
I was hooked on phonics.
This is probably one of the worst tools for this job, but because you're so familiar, you'll justify it being better because you're afraid of trying something different.
There's this delicate balance between not underselling yourself and being overconfident.
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
So, David, last week we talked about whether or not free speech makes sense online. And
yes,
talked about censorship and online spaces, primarily based on an article called Well-Kept Gardens Die by Pacifism.
Yes.
By Eliza Yudkowsky. Is that how you pronounce that name?
That's how I pronounced it last week. Yeah,
good enough for me. But we're back again this week, I think. Is that what you brought me? Is that what you brought for us this week?
Yes. Well, yeah. During that, he referenced his own other essay called The Sin of Underconfidence. So we're doing that today.
All right.
Neither of us have read this in advance, by the way. We're going in cold.
Yeah. Going in cold, low effort for low light winters. So,
yeah, we can't even do the no effort November thing.
No, well, we're doing it. We're so low effort. We push it off to
December.
Right.
Low effort December. Can't even come up with an alliteration.
Mm-hmm. So this does appear to be this is even shorter than the other one. So I think we could just do it in the same fashion.
Okay.
Let's begin then. So this is The Sin of Underconfidence by Eliza Yudkowsky, circa the 20th of April, 2009, when this was published. There are three great besetting sins of rationalists in particular, and the third of these is underconfidence. Michael Yassar regularly accuses me of this sin, which makes him unique among the entire population of the earth. Called out in the first paragraph. I had to stop myself from saying, oh, the third of these sins is like, oh, that means there are two more articles that we need to read next, which he didn't link to, but
no,
we'll move on, I guess. But he's actually quite right to worry, and I worry too, and any adept rationalist will probably spend a fair amount of time worrying about it. When subjects know about a bias or are warned about a bias, overcorrection is not unheard of as an experimental result. That's what makes a lot of cognitive subtasks so troublesome. You know you're biased, but you're not sure how much, and you don't know if you're correcting enough, and so perhaps you ought to correct a little more, and then a little more, but is that enough? Or have you perhaps far overshot? Are you now perhaps worse off than if you hadn't tried any correction? You begin to contemplate the matter, feeling more and more lost, and the very task of estimation begins to feel increasingly futile. So before we continue on.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about these first three paragraphs so far?
Yeah, well, hilarious that he calls out like somebody that he personally knows.
Name drops him in the very first. Yeah, hilarious. Yeah,
I had no idea who that person is.
Me either.
And I assume that this is not a person that anyone should know about.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of his acquaintances that he talks to a lot. But yes, so the bit about overcorrection is interesting, and that has been kind of my experience,
personally or with others or both
with others. Okay. So, I mean, we could, and we may by the end of this do a whole episode about biases. Mm-hmm. If we haven't already. I don't think we have though.
Maybe not.
Or if we have, it's been a long time. So yeah, one about biases, because my opinion about biases has changed many times.
Hmm.
I mean, I think we can all agree that biases are
real
and bad. Like from a rationalist perspective, right?
Fair enough.
They cloud your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They are enemies of the truth.
They're enemies of objectivism for sure.
Right. So So in that sense, they're bad. But also, but for the exact reason mentioned in this paragraph, I've kind of stopped caring as much, mm-hmm. I guess. Because I've seen people go into like groupthink and come up with all kinds of ridiculous like demands of people to try to correct for their biases and stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't know. I feel like the pains people go through to try to combat their own biases do more damage than the biases themselves. And so I've kind of stopped caring as much. It also depends on which bias, right?
Mm-hmm.
So confirmation bias is one that I still do try very hard to correct for. This is probably where he's going with it, right? This is about overconfidence or underconfidence, rather. So
mm-hmm.
correcting for confirmation bias means doubting yourself, right?
Right.
That rather than seeing something and being like, aha, this confirms my worldview, you see the thing, think, aha, this confirms my worldview, and then that triggers a response of, but maybe it shouldn't. Right. And now I must doubt myself because I know that this is a bias that I have.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't thought about it too much. I think I would like to say that I am not afraid of my opinion being challenged. And that's true. That's not what I'm afraid to say. What I'm afraid to say is that I've never actually thought about it.
Mm.
And I kind of guess that I figure at the moment without having given it too much thought that it's, you know, I have biases. I can acknowledge that that's true, but so does everyone else. So one of the ways you can help combat a bias is by just communicating exactly your perspective on things and the way you see it.
And accepting challenges. Yeah.
And accept the challenge. And if you're not afraid of the challenge, you don't need to worry about being wrong. And that's something that I've never really been bothered by, you know, being wrong. It's concerning when you say something and someone goes, well, that's just not true. Like a good example happened recently is, I think it was my wife and I were talking about something and I was like, more people die in the US every year to other weapons besides guns. And she was like, I don't think that's true. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, logically in her mind, if you are going into a homicide with the intention of killing someone, and I guess to be fair, the exact prompt that was given that I gave was that more homicides are committed by other things besides guns, other mm-hmm. implements. And she was like, I don't think that's true. She's like, because it doesn't make sense. If you want to kill somebody, why would you reach for an inferior tool if you had a more readily available one?
Well,
right?
But that also presupposes that you do have a better one, right?
Sure.
Not everyone does have a gun, even in America.
That's true. But still, in my head, that didn't ring as true. But I was also associating that with the death rate. I was thinking about, like, doesn't matter. Firearm deaths as opposed to homicides. How those get lumped together. That's what I was thinking about. So when she said that, I was like, well, there's an easy way we can figure it out. So I just Googled it and looked up the FBI crime statistic data on it. And she's actually correct. That is, firearms are the number one implement used in homicide mm-hmm. in the US. And granted, that includes justified homicides.
Right.
But still, and the reason she told me that is she's like, well, you can't say that. She's like, if you were arguing with someone and that came up, that could be a problem. Like, if you say something that's just blatantly untrue.
Right, then you hang yourself by your own bad data, yeah.
Right. And so I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm wrong. And that's fine, you know? And at that point, it's something I think the best you can do is to just admit very plainly that you're wrong move on. Like, because otherwise, if you try to go, well, I actually thought it was
that's just called intellectual honesty, right? Yeah. Just admitting when you're wrong, which is sadly not a common trait.
So
that doesn't have too much to do with biases.
Well, but here's the thing.
I guess you made a biased assumption.
Maybe, but I guess the way I'm trying to tie this back to bias, though, is that it's about a bias about what the confirmation bias you mentioned before. It's like, well, I am right. I said something. I see something that reinforces that I'm right. Okay, cool. It's right. If you are afraid of, you wouldn't care, I think, about that too much unless you were afraid of being wrong for the reason of, oh, not only was I wrong, but it's because of my bias I was wrong. Mm. And I think in some circles, especially nowadays, that is, it's like being wrong is not immoral. It's just ignorance. But being biasedly wrong is somehow immoral. It's kind of how it's treated. Like it's...
Yes, it's original sin.
Exactly. And so it's because of that, that you, everyone has to just admit that they are biased, right? But the actual instantiation of your bias coming true, it doesn't... If you meet a guy or a gal who never speaks, you can assume they have a bias, but no evidence of that bias can manifest, right? If they never act. But as soon as you act, the act of doing something wrong brings the bias with it.
The fear of bias has a chilling effect.
Yeah. On acting, or speaking. So.
Okay.
Yeah, let's read on, I think. Do you want to go on this one?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. All right. Did you ever want to read in school out loud, or were you much happier to let someone else do it?
I think it changed twice.
Okay.
So I started off liking to read, I think. It's been a long time though, so maybe I'm not remembering this right. But anyway, I feel like I started off enjoying reading because I could read better than most of my peers okay, I'm going to reveal a thing about myself.
Ooh.
A thing about my childhood.
Let's do it.
Okay, so I was raised from an early age by my grandparents.
Okay.
And they figured out early on that I was somewhat smart. And so they really leaned into it. They did the parent of a smart kid thing.
Okay.
And started like getting me educational stuff to do as a little kid, which is fine.
Lucky.
So one of those things is... I'm pretty sure this is still considered a meme. Hooked on phonics.
Hooked on phonics.
I was hooked on phonics.
Nice.
So I learned how to read when I was like, I don't know, 3 or 4. Which I feel like is not very early, but I guess a lot of people don't even start learning until they're in kindergarten.
I was gonna say, do you know when I actually was able to pass a reading competency test?
No.
7.
Ouch.
I almost didn't make it to second grade.
Yeah, so I went into first grade at a third grade reading level, so I could read better than all of my peers because I had started very early. So I liked reading then because I knew how to do it already. It wasn't really a challenge for me. I was just doing the thing. Then I stopped caring later when reading kind of became work. Mm-hmm. It wasn't this cool new thing that I could do. It was like, okay, this chore that I have to do because the teacher wants me to. Mm-hmm. That was when it became kind of bored and dissatisfied with school, which is a whole different story. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I got to high school, I liked reading in front of the class again because everyone else was so bad at it that I couldn't stand it.
Yep.
And I'm like, dear God, I don't want to do this, but please let me so that I'm not thinking about ways to kill myself in this class.
So we can get this over with because I'm having to read it anyway because I don't understand what you're saying because you keep...
And you don't know how to pronounce words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who, brother? Yes, that's a feel. Yeah, 100% agree. So while I may have not been able to pass a reading competency test until I was 7 years old and trying to make it into the second grade, once I was... What's funny about that is I could read aloud, no problem. But I couldn't comprehend it. Like, I was full-on extrovert.
You're speaking the words but not understanding them.
I was like an LLM. Yeah, I could do the words. I could make the sounds that made people go, yeah, he knows how to read. But the content of what I was saying didn't...
No comprehension.
Yeah. No, didn't get it. But then after that, it took off and I was fine. And so my initial love of reading in the class was, yeah, I like talking. I like other people listening to me. This is great.
This is a way for me to do that. Yeah.
This is a great way for me to do that. And the teachers knew it. And I was a teacher's pet. And they loved letting me do it because they also, I think, low-key hated listening to idiot fourth graders try to read stupid crap. And so loved it. That also is why I got really good at writing, because if you wrote well,
you got to read.
You got to read. Yeah. So I got to write my own stories to read. Yeah. It was a whole thing. It was totally worth it. And then later on it became more of a facsimile of like, God, I cannot stand you are nearly an adult, and when you're reading this, it's like, and when it comes to the particular question, it's
shut
just
up.
Like, it's like, God, stop. Just let me do it. And it came to a head when I was taking World Lit in high school, and we had to read Tennessee Williams, I think, plays. I think it's who it is.
Okay.
And I just started reading the whole play by myself because I was so sick of it. I was like, I'm going to play these eight parts because they have the most things. And I would even pitch my voice around. And the teacher was dealing, I think, with cancer or something at that point. And so she was not even paying attention. She barely paid attention anyway, but like, you know, personal life stuff going on. You don't have a real job anyway. So what's the point, you know? Yeah, it was a whole thing. So sidebar closed. Back to
no more story time. Back to the essay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Continuing. And when it comes to the particular questions of confidence, overconfidence, and underconfidence, being interpreted now in the broader sense, not just calibrated confidence intervals, then there is a natural tendency to cast overconfidence as the sin of pride, and out of that other list, which never warned against the improper use of humility. Hold on. This is a hyperlink. Okay, never mind. All right. Which never warned against the improper use of humility or the abuse of doubt. To place yourself too high, to overreach your proper place, to think too much of yourself, to put yourself forward, to put down your fellows by implicit comparison, and the consequences of humiliation and being cast down, perhaps publicly, are these not loathsome and fearsome things? To be too modest seems lighter by comparison. It wouldn't be so humiliating to be called on it publicly. Indeed, finding out that you're better than you imagine might come as a warm surprise, and to put yourself down, and others implicitly above, has a positive tinge of niceness about it. It's the sort of thing that Gandalf would do. So if you've learned 1,000 ways that humans fall into error and read 100 experimental results in which anonymous subjects are humiliated of their overconfidence, heck, even if you just read a couple of dozen and you don't know exactly how overconfident you are, then yes, you might genuinely be in danger of nudging yourself a step too far down.
So he did have two hyperlinks against the improper use of humility or the abuse of doubt, which are other articles, one he wrote and the other, I don't know if he wrote. It's just a website called overcomingbias.com, this is someone else.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure they're both someone else, yeah.
No, The Proper Use of Humility is also by Eliza Yudkowsky.
Interesting.
It's,
okay.
Yeah, to the same website, too. Not going there. I think he's genuine. I think the part where he was talking about the social interaction of it, of if you're overconfident, it has a stink socially to it, whereas right. Underconfident has a, it's like a what's the word I'm looking for here, it's like endearing sometimes to be underconfident, mixed with the whole, well, the very common mentality of I would rather be pleasantly surprised than, you know, surprisingly upset kind of mentality. I think the confluence of those three things really does make it easier for others to encourage a sense of underconfidence. You know, in the prisoner's dilemma of the ways you could be, I feel like underconfidence is one of the natural states that the system will collapse to most often.
Yeah. So personal anecdote, I guess that is related to this, very short. So as you know, Joe, I am president of a local special interest group.
I sound like a lobbyist, but go on.
I know that does sound very political. It's not.
Well, no, I'm just kidding.
And I've been elected as the president again for the next year.
Congratulations.
And one of the things that one of the comments that somebody made to me after that was, okay, I wasn't even, there has not been an election, but I am the only one running. No one ran against me. But a comment that I received was, yeah, I'm happy to have you again as president because you're not controversial.
Yep. You're safe.
Right. And I think that does come down to the level of confidence. Not that I don't feel like I'm very like timid in front of the group.
No.
But when, yeah, people might say something that I don't necessarily agree with, but I'll just kind of go along with it. Mm-hmm. During the, I mean, unless it's just egregiously wrong, but that doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. So yeah, people like me because I don't step on toes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't display much. I don't boast. I'm not confident like that.
Yeah. We need to do an episode maybe about this at some point too. So this is another food for thought thing. It is very interesting how there are local minimums of stable states in a social strata,
mm-hmm.
where of different sizes, where if you are very confident, right, or you're very boastful and outspoken, there is a place you can actually get to, I think, where people actually are okay with it. But on either side,
yeah, there's a certain type of charisma in being mm-hmm. very confident.
Yep. But there's also a vast valley of you don't rock the boat where the majority sits, I think, of people. Like mm-hmm. there are a lot of people that they're more than content to go about their daily lives and just live the routine. And anybody who doesn't disrupt the routine by meeting all of the socially acceptable things that we kind of push out there, get a good enough pass. And then there is another local minima around like people who are like more withdrawn from society, but there's a right and a wrong way. So it's like no matter which mode you want to interact and operate within society, there is a right and a wrong way to be that way. I think it'd be interesting to discuss how, if you were to graph this and look at it, could yet tell you something about A, the society, or B, what the outcomes would be. Because I think there are times when there have been societies where socially there are way more boastful people and way more energy in the society itself, and that yields an outcome. And then there's also societies where it's not just pleasant to not rock the boat, but like it is almost strictly enforced in a way. Like I'm thinking about societies with very strict social hierarchies, like especially those with like, I'm thinking more East Asian, like Japanese and Korean cultures, where yeah, there's a very strict hierarchical structure, and because of that everyone kind of wants to be not rocking the boat
mm-hmm.
until you get like 90 years old, and then you can literally just do whatever you want. You know what I mean? Because everybody has to respect you or something like mm-hmm. that. It's very interesting.
Shall I continue?
I was just scanning it again to make sure there was anything else. I feel like this is a pretty straightforward, long-winded way. Nice Gandalf comment.
Yes.
I actually don't agree. If you read the book, he's not like that at all. He's actually very assertive,
mm-hmm.
but that's okay. Reading's hard, I guess. But it's just straight up. yeah, let's keep going. Okay. I think there's, yeah, we're about half, no, we're not even halfway through. Keep on.
Yeah, we still need to get to the next point.
Keep on keeping on, I guess.
All right. I have no perfect formula to give you that will counteract this, but I have an item or two of advice. What is the danger of underconfidence? Passing up opportunities. Not doing things you could have done, but didn't try. Hard enough. So here's a first item of advice. If there's a way to find out how good you are, the thing to do is test it. A hypothesis affords testing. Hypotheses about your own abilities likewise. Once upon a time, it seemed to me that I ought to be able to win at the AI box experiment. And it seemed like a very doubtful and hubristic thought, so I tested it. Then later it seemed to me that I might be able to win even with large sums of money at stake, and I tested that. But I only won one time out of three. So that was the limit of my ability at the time, and it was not necessary to argue myself upward or downward, because I could just test it. One of the chief ways that smart people end up stupid is by getting so used to winning that they stick to places where they know they can win, meaning they can never stretch their abilities and they never try anything difficult. It is said that this is linked to defining yourself in terms of your intelligence rather than your effort, because then winning easily is a sign of your intelligence, where falling on a hard problem could have been interpreted in terms of good effort.
I don't know what the AI box experiment is.
Let's see.
God, he
literally his own website.
Literally his own website. This man.
This guy.
I don't know. The fact that he has to like this is multiple pages of explanation. I'm going to just assume
we're not doing this.
It's a legitimate test.
Yeah.
What do you think about what he said in the second to last, or maybe it's the last paragraph? It is said that it is linked to defining yourself in terms of intelligence. I guess the one before that, where
sticking to places where you know you can win.
Yeah.
I can see that. I think it is. I think it's. It is easy to get into a comfortable place, doing things that you're good at and feeling good about yourself, because you're winning, but only because you're not actually doing things that are meaningful and challenging.
Yeah.
If you never fail, your goals should be set higher, basically.
Yeah.
If you're not failing, you're doing something wrong.
Right. But if you're always failing, you're also doing something wrong.
That's also true. You can't always fail, but if you want to say that you're doing something meaningful, you should be failing frequently.
Yeah. I think it's fair. I know a lot of people like this, me included, that like to do this. I run into it all the time. So I work in software, and it's very easy to find people who like got really good at their particular ecosystem or language or something like that. And it's easy to just say, I can do anything in this. And it starts out with pushing the limits of what can be done with that set of tools, for example. And then it ends up with being faced with a problem where it's like, this is probably one of the worst tools for this job. But because you're so familiar, you'll justify it being better because you're afraid of trying something different. And
I'm the master of the jackhammer. I can frame a house with this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 100%. I can paint a house with this rake. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think that's absolutely a thing. And so, yeah.
Okay.
I'll continue.
Okay.
Now, I'm not quite sure this is how an adept rationalist should think about these things. Rationality is systemized winning, and trying to try seems like a path to failure. I would put it this way. A hypothesis affords testing. You don't know whether you'll win on a hard problem, then challenge your... Oh, I misspoke. If you don't know whether you'll win on a hard problem, then challenge your rationality to discover your current level. I don't usually hold with congratulating yourself on having tried. It seems like a bad mental habit to me, but surely not. Trying is even worse. If you have cultivated a general habit of confronting challenges and won on at least some of them, then you may, perhaps, think to yourself, why did I keep up my habit of confronting challenges? Did I skip a sentence or a line?
Think to yourself, I did keep up my habit.
Yeah, thank you. Think to yourself, I did keep up with my habit of confronting challenges, and will do so next time as well. You may also think to yourself, I have gained valuable information about my current level and where I need improvement. So long as you properly complete the thought, I shall try not to gain this same valuable information again next time. If you win every time, it means you aren't stretching yourself enough, but you should seriously try to win every time. And if you console yourself too much for failure, you lose your winning spirit and become a scrub. Nice. I think that's pretty much exactly what we just kind of talked about in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So unless there's also nice use of the word scrub.
I appreciate scrub.
Did you look at the link for that?
I hovered over it. Yeah.
Yeah. Too bad it's not just a Urban Dictionary definition of the word scrub.
No.
But I can continue on, since I think, unless you have anything else to add. Okay. When I was trying to imagine what a fictional master of the competitive conspiracy would say about this, it comes out something like, it's not okay to lose, but the hurt of losing is not something so scary that you should flee the challenge for fear of it. It's not so scary that you have to carefully avoid feeling it, or refuse to admit that you lost and lost hard. Losing is supposed to hurt. If it didn't hurt, you wouldn't be a competitor. there is no competitor who never knows the pain of losing. Now get out there and win. Cultivating a habit of confronting challenges, not the ones that can kill you outright, perhaps, but perhaps ones that can potentially humiliate you. I recently read of a certain theist that he had defeated Christopher Hitchens in a debate. Severely so, this was said by atheists. And so I wrote at once to the blogging heads folks and asked if they could arrange a debate. This seemed like someone I wanted to test myself against. Also, it was said by them that Christopher Hitchens should have watched the theists' earlier debates and been prepared, so I decided not to do that, because I think I should be able to handle damn near anything on the fly, and I desire to learn whether this thought is correct, and I am willing to risk public humiliation to find out. Note that this is not self-handicapping in the classic sense. If the debate is indeed arranged, I haven't yet heard back, and I do not prepare, and I fail, then I do lose those stakes of myself I have put up. I gain information about my limits. I have not given myself anything I consider an excuse for losing. That sounds a little copy to me, to be honest.
Maybe.
I mean, it sounds like a rationalization about a legitimate claim that is okay to be correct. A bit. I don't know. Like,
well, his thesis here is like, if you think that you're smart, then you should put that to the test. And so he's basically saying, I have this intuition about myself that I should be able to hold my own in a debate, right? I'm a rational thinker. And so no stranger should be able to come up to me and humiliate me on stage unless they're actually right.
Yeah.
And I'm wrong. And as he, so he's like, okay, well, I accept this as a challenge then. I will, instead of just thinking this about myself and stroking my own ego, I'm going to actually ask to set up the debate, and I'm going to intentionally not do the research that it was recommended I do before confronting this person. I should be able to do it on the fly, or I will learn that I'm not actually that smart and capable.
Mm-hmm. I just think of the way it was written, it made it sound semi-spiteful, because it was literally written, so I decided not to do that, like, mm-hmm, specifically because other people said that I should have prepared. Now, don't get me wrong, that can be true. And it could be said that that's literally not the point. But it was kind of funny. I don't know. I just feel like it was kind of wordy. Like, in my mind, I get what he's saying.
This guy is kind of wordy.
Yeah, I get what he's saying. It's not about winning. It's about winning the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Winning rationally through good debate, not through gamesmanship. But that wasn't mentioned directly. It was more about his limits, which, to be fair, is maybe more on par for the point of the article, so maybe that's why it is the way it is. But
well, remember, this article is about confidence, right? So mm-hmm, he's confident that he can do it, right? Whereas, right, if he doubted himself, then he would have taken other people's advice and watched like every debate that other guy had ever had, and like thoroughly considered every single argument, so that he would just walk in with a list, like a script of replies to whatever he might say.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not the same.
Yeah, that is interesting to think about too. Preparation versus confidence. That's mm-hmm, an interesting thought, which I don't know if he's going to address later. So maybe I'll hold off until, I don't want to read ahead. I confidently don't want to read ahead. yeah, exactly. Well, I am reading ahead a bit. I don't think because it's not really the point,
right?
But I do think it might be, you know, we're not writing this article right now. No. Can wander off the point. That's kind of the point of a podcast, and so, or whatever we're doing here. So I will say that, I don't think there's anything wrong with, obviously this should go without saying, there's nothing wrong with preparing yourself for something. But I think it depends on the stakes,
mm-hmm,
you know, especially like if life, limb, or particularly valuable time or money is involved, probably better to be prepared.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Well, I think the idea is that you should have, this actually echoes back to what he was saying in the essay that we read last week, which is actually technically the sequel to this essay,
mm-hmm,
which is about being a forum moderator, basically don't question yourself, mm-hmm. right? Or like don't doubt your intuition so much, right? You have a goal in mind, you are qualified to do it, you should do it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you should also not be
afraid to get it wrong.
That's his thesis here, or his thesis then was that you shouldn't be afraid to get it wrong. But I think the counter to this is that you also need to still have a realistic idea of your abilities. So like, okay, for instance, when I think about like a completely different sort of challenge that someone might accept, and do something that would be dangerous because of their confidence, let's think about something like rock climbing, right? That's a dangerous activity. And people might wisely advise you, Joe, you're going to go climb this cliff or whatever like that. And someone might rightly advise you, you should wear a harness, right? And have a safety crew to make sure that you don't fall and die.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, I think I can do it. And you just do it without the harness and you fall down and die inevitably because you're not practiced at rock climbing.
Mm-hmm.
I assume. So
I'm not.
Because normally you can tell if people are into rock climbing because they tell you.
True. There's a casual explain video about that.
Is there?
There is. Shout out.
Yeah, I guess there probably is. Okay. Anyway, so yeah. So, but there are rock climbers who do that, who do climb like actual cliff faces without safety gear.
Or anything.
Because they know they can do it. But it's because they know they can do it. They've already done it with the safety gear.
Right.
And completed it successfully without relying on the safety gear to save them. Right. It was mm-hmm. always there in case they messed up, but they didn't. So they learned that they were able to do it. And then they went forward having that rational confidence in their abilities because they already had solved the problems with the safety net or the harness or whatever. Now, you can argue whether it's rational to climb rock faces without safety gear at all. But the point is that they're not being overconfident. They're being appropriately confident as opposed to being someone who might be an amazing athlete, an expert rock climber, who is terrified to do it without the safety gear. Even though they have this feeling to themselves like, yeah, I could probably do that. Right. I've demonstrated that I should be able to do it, but I'm not going to because I'm not confident enough about it.
You know, there's an interesting analog here.
Okay.
About society.
We do live in one.
We live in one. Factually correct. I feel like there's an interesting analog with how society views stories to this. So we tell stories to teach lessons and communicate those lessons, right? It's one of the main reasons we do it. It's also entertaining because we literally cannot experience reality any other way without a conscious narrative, really, unless you take substances or something or you put yourself in an interesting situation. Generally speaking, the average person consumes reality via a narrative structure, right? And so we create our narrative structures to mirror that because it's familiar. That being said, how many times have you seen the story of it? All it took was your confidence.
Mm.
That's a good story.
It's a great story. It's also not true.
Well, sometimes it is true.
Mm.
Okay. All it takes is your confidence is not true.
Right.
But sometimes all you were missing was confidence is true.
Yes.
But those two stories are very easy to get mixed up. And good example.
All it takes is your confidence is literally fake it till you make it.
Yes.
Which sometimes does work.
It actually does work. Yes. Especially in
jobs. Depends on what the stakes are.
Right. But I do find it particularly interesting that there are a lot of things like that where, like, and you see it in children the most because children are the most overconfident things on the planet.
Yes.
And stupid.
Yes.
And constantly.
Yeah, they're the most confident and least capable among us. Yes.
Exactly. However, and those stories are very appealing to them. So I don't know about you, but have you ever witnessed someone so deep in overconfidence headspace that they actually do accept some kind of challenge and absolutely get their comeuppance for it, or was so delusional that they like took a challenge that they had no business taking, but no one stopped them.
I've seen lots of this on the internet.
I've seen it in real life.
I've seen lots of people get knocked out.
Yep. I've seen it in real life. I have seen the guy who watched The Karate Kid when he was 5 and thought, oh, simple, easy, do it. Takes karate classes. Yeah, karate's the best. I'm the best at the karate because it's a classroom setting where, of course, if you weren't, you wouldn't keep paying to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying. Then grows into a teenager who decides to confront the bully and absolutely gets destroyed because the bully actually knows how to fight because they're a bully. That's what they do, you know? But you never see that story told in the movies because, the way the narrative should go is that the underdog should defeat the bully and everything is right with the world.
But not all is right with the world.
And yeah, you don't live in a story. So I watched.
So instead, you embarrass yourself colossally.
And not only that, I was friends with this person and got to witness just the most severe, like, come back to reality. Like, it broke his entire worldview. Like, he didn't just lose the fight. He wasn't just humiliated. His entire perception of reality was shattered as well. Like, his entire understanding of how the world is, should be, all that changed. And we were, like, 12, I think we were right under being teenagers, or right after that pointless barrier, where we decided that, oh, unlike every other, you know, tens place, you know, these two, 11 and 12, get special names instead of 11T and 12T or 2T, you know.
One teen and two teen, or whatever.
First teen and second teen, I think, is actually what it would be because it's 13 and 14. I don't know. Doesn't matter. This is not the debate today. This is not a Jan Measley video. We're not doing this.
Yeah, shout outs to Jan Measley, who would actually do a video about this.
No. I don't want a 4-hour long video.
He doesn't make 4-hour long videos.
Feels like it's
He educates you long. Enough for 4 hours, but it's only about 30 minutes.
Not the point. However, I was friends with this person, and it was a very interesting experience to watch them reconstruct a worldview as a rational person. They weren't because they were 12, but like more rational than a 4-year-old. You know what I mean? And so what's the point of all that story? The point, I guess, is that I don't think most people are delusional. I hope not, because it would be really sad to think that our society gets on by a mass delusion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the point of this episode. So I do totally think there's something interesting about how this over and under confidence may or may not get... It's a meme, I think, that gets communicated through these viral bodies-like stories. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how... The wrong person reading this article can take the wrong thing away from it and have a worse outcome.
Yes, there's a, and I guess that's where I was trying to get to, is like there's this delicate balance between not underselling yourself and being overconfident. Like, you don't want to be underconfident, but you also don't want to be overconfident because you can hurt yourself.
And I think we're also in a very interesting place where, because everybody can talk to everybody all the time, but because we don't know everybody the way we used to know people, you can get a lot of interesting advice on the internet about what you should do. Like, dating advice is a great one.
Oh my goodness.
Guys, I'm scared to talk to girls. What do I do? Instead of...
Oh, that's not even where I was going with it, but okay, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's the one I...
Okay, I don't know how to talk to girls, so...
Yeah. Without skipping a beat, there will be a Giga Chad in your face in a heart's beat, or at least that's what he has the Giga Chad profile pic, you know. Bro, here's what you do. And like, it's never, well... Is there a girl you're interested in? What are your strengths, weaknesses? Where are you at? Trying to figure out?
Yeah.
Where is this person at? How old are you? Are you 10?
Right.
Or are you 50? Like, how old are you? Because
the answer is going to change a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead, it's crush some creatine or whatever. Hit the gym. Get hot.
and then walk up to her and be like, sup, babe. Like, and, like, it's always some, like, the bog standard alpha male advice. A
fantasy of somebody.
Literally, yes.
Who probably doesn't have a girlfriend, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Who also is a neckbeard version. And, you know, like, it, but you see what I'm saying. Like, now, don't be wrong. As cringe as that is, there actually might be men out there who is like, actually, yes, that's all you need to actually do is just walk up to them and talk. Like, start talk to your friends. And then remember how that sounds and then turn to the girl and then keep doing it. You're fine.
Yes. You're meeting a new person. That's what you're doing.
But there are people who should never talk to women the way they talk to their friends who go, okay, I'm going to try it. So I was watching Guts the other day or some anime and she's just like, what, you know, like, or
not, yeah, to, not don't to crap talk on to her. Anime. Don't talk to a stranger. About like anime. Someone that you've known for years. Yeah.
That's weird.
Because that's because you don't.
Yeah. And so I don't know. It's just funny because I think that's one of the big things missing is lessons about like this get communicated all the time. And no one ever bothers to. It's like even though we are more aware than ever of other people, it's like we have less permanence than ever, or not permanence. What's the thing? What's the name of for the phenomena of realizing that other people are discrete entities that are outside of yourself and have a different perspective? It's after permanence. Like once you realize that things don't just disappear once they're out of your frame of vision and no longer exist until they re-enter your vision, you need that first. You get that around some age when you're a child and start to understand that, oh, I put the candy under the rock and it's Sonder still there.
Is the word.
Sonder?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. When you develop, is the correct usage, when you develop Sonder, would that be a correct way to say that?
Yeah, Sonder, a noun. The profound feeling of realizing that everyone, including strangers passing in the street, has a life as complex as one's own, which they are constantly living despite one's personal lack of awareness of it.
Yeah, literally that. That's a great word. I need to commit that to memory. We are more aware of those people than ever, but we are least Sonder than ever because I see so much advice just getting fired off that has, it might work for somebody. But probably not most people, mm-hmm. You know, and that's just interesting.
So. That word is from 2012, by the way. It's a very new word.
Interesting. Wonder why that didn't. I wonder if someone came with that word just to describe what we're missing instead of like, you know, what's occurring. Because I do not feel like most people have a rational understanding that other people are like, most people do not have a prescient understanding that other people out there may actually just have an entirely different experience and that what you're about to tell them will not work for them.
Well, we have an internet meme term for the opposite of this, which is main character syndrome.
Well, it's kind of both. I think they're related.
Yes.
Because if you're giving this advice to them, like, good example. Great example. Difference between Western and Japanese RPGs actually has a very interesting thing. So for those of you who don't know in these terms, these are role-playing games where you play a character. The key difference, though, between a Western RPG and a Japanese RPG is JRPGs, at least from my understanding, you're not the main character. You are, because you're playing a character, but you're not the point. The story doesn't revolve around you. There's usually some other thing, and you act to affect the world. Whereas in Western RPGs are usually more power fantasy related, where no, you are the main character. Things do not happen until you show up. You know, I think the Oblivion and the Elder Scrolls games are just like perfect examples mm-hmm. of this, where it's like, oh, I showed up, joined the Thieves Guild, and then stole everything, and now I'm run the Thieves Guild. And no one else had ever done that. Now I'm going to leave and go to the Wizard Academy and become the best wizard ever in like 2 days because I showed up. You know, I'm right. special.
And I am a legend. Yeah.
And I'm a legend. And then people go into the world like, I am a legend. You know, I think it's very similar to that. But if you have that mentality, then, you know, you see it in movies all the time or in these games. It's perpetuated that, yeah, all you have to do is say the right words. And if it sounds good, feels good, if it inspires the same feeling that you get in the movie when you watch the Uncle Ben tell the young boy, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and that just clicks and makes everything work. Wow. But if you're ever in that spot where you say that, it feels really good to say until the person goes, huh, I get it. And then they like step into the street and get hit by a bus. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, that didn't happen in the movie. Like, whoops. Yeah, it's a very sobering, you know, humbling feeling for sure. Yes. I don't even know where we left off. Do you have the spot?
I do.
Okay, I'll let you take it then.
All right. Of course, this is only a way to think when you really are confronting a challenge just to test yourself, and not because you have to win at any cost. In that case, you make everything as easy for yourself as possible. To do otherwise would be spectacular overconfidence, even if you're playing tic-tac-toe against a three-year-old. Which is what we were just talking
literally
about, basically.
Yeah.
A subtler form of underconfidence is losing your forward momentum amid all the things you realize that humans are doing wrong, that you used to be doing wrong, of which you are probably still doing some wrong. You become timid, you question yourself, but don't answer the self questions and move on. When you hypothesize your own inability, you do not put that hypothesis to the test. Perhaps without there ever being a watershed moment when you deliberately, self-visibly decide not to try at some particular test, you just slow down. It doesn't seem worthwhile anymore to go on trying to fix one thing when there are a dozen other things that will still be wrong. There's not enough hope of triumph to inspire you to try hard. When you consider doing any new thing, a dozen questions about your ability at once leap into your mind, and it does not occur to you that you could answer the questions by testing yourself. And having read so much wisdom of human flaws, it seems that the course of wisdom is ever doubting, never resolving doubts, ever the humility of refusal, never the humility of preparation, and just generally that it is wise to say worse and worse things about human abilities to pass into feel good, feel bad cynicism.
Oof.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think that the slowing down is such a, that's a mood.
Yeah.
It's such a mood.
I've been there. Yeah.
I'm there right now, actually. So yeah, I totally feel it. Yeah. It is a very defeating feeling to look at a problem and just think, what's the point? Like,
yeah,
I mean, I could try, but even if I succeeded, it wouldn't change much.
Mm-hmm.
I think this also smells like nihilism a little bit, because I think nihilism has a very similar kind of
ebb.
It can
have that chilling effect. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like
the realization that, it doesn't matter how good I do, we're all going to die.
God. except not that abrupt. It's like laying, it's like feeling normal and then lying down in a like half inch deep cold pool. Mm-hmm. It will slowly just sap away your energy and just make you not want, make just extreme lethargy, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember, we've talked about this before, you know, I never really had much of an angry atheist phase, because I just kind of slowly fell out of faith. I never had like that sticker shock moment of like, this is all a lie. I've been wasting so much time. Oh man.
I've been duped.
This is not fair. I must now firmly establish myself in the new camp. And to do so, I am going to burn down the old as best as I can. Mm-hmm. No, it was more of a wandering in the wilderness and then coming back out and being like, yeah, no, it's all crap. Like, you know. But I did end up right after, and then for a while end up in that place where it's like, well, you know, I had accepted that reasons for doing things did not no longer need to be this axiomatic God thing.
God decided. Yeah.
Yeah. But I had not yet reached this place where I was comfortable saying, well, but I want to is just as good.
Right.
Because we're told all
the time. What's the difference between God's arbitrary decision and yours? They're both arbitrary.
True. But I think that the difference is that if you're in that faith a long time, God is special.
Well, yeah.
You're not special.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and not only that.
Yeah, you're programmed to think that way. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You're programmed to think you are nothing.
And wanting to do something for your own sake is not valued. Yeah. But,
right.
Yeah. But that's the freedom of nihilism also is,
I'm not special.
I'm not special. And it doesn't matter. So I'm going to do what I want. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly. So, but those two things don't happen back to back. Like when you read the sentence, you know, I forget when it was. This reminds me of a time when, I think it was back when I was religious and they were talking about the beginning of time and how beginning of everything, how there are like nine sentences, but like,
the big debate about the first so many sentences of Genesis are, but exactly what is the time span?
Mm-hmm.
Because you read them one after the other.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. It's, yeah, boom, 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 boom,
then this,
boom.
Then this, yeah.
Yeah. But some things, when it's this and this and this, no, they all happened at the same time, was one argument. But the this then here, before that, yeah, that could be infinity. Like, infinitely long.
Eons. Yeah.
Eons, right? And so, it's easy to talk about the process of going through this and not, it's not a good communicator of the reality of maybe experiencing some of that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the two-sided coin of nihilism, you usually don't get both sides at the same time. You get that coin and you get one side of it, and it takes a very long time before you flip that coin over and see the other, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you, like, can be told what it is, you don't actually, like... Have you ever been told something and you can just, like, you rationally get it, you understand the words that were said to you, but it's not for a significant period of time later until it, like, it just, all of a sudden, oh... I get it now. Like, I understand now. I thought I understood then, but now I really get it. Or, like, this really resonates for some reason now.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was at in that. And I kind of still am in that place where it's like, but about different things, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'm no longer that way about what I want to do. But now it's at a place where it's like, now I'm okay being content to say, yeah, what I want to do is perfectly legitimate and a perfectly worthwhile goal to pursue. But now it's like, why are some things more important to me than other things?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I want to do this so much? Like, if I'm going to die anyways, like, if I'm going to pursue something for 20 years, but then only get to enjoy it for 20, is it worth it?
Well, you get to enjoy it for 20 instead of zero.
Right. But it's like the lost, it's like the sunk cost fallacy. It's like somewhat. It's
okay.
You get so caught up examining the lost opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. It's not really sunk cost. It's the lost opportunity cost you start thinking about. It's like, man, that's 20 years. What all could I have done?
What else could you do? Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's not so much...
Yep, you have to choose.
And that, yeah. And honestly, being in that place where you don't know which one to pick...
Yeah, the decision paralysis is very dangerous, yeah.
I think it's related to this sin of underconfidence, and I think underconfidence can lead to that scenario where you don't know which
you're
one
trying
to pursue.
I'm trying to decide the next thing that I want to do, and every time I come up with something that sounds like a good idea, I shoot it down because it's impossible for one reason or another, right?
Right, or I could, and it's possible, but is it worth it, or, mm-hmm. you know, am I sure that I'll like it when I get it, you know, yeah. That's a poison.
And someone else has already done it probably already. Or even if they haven't already done it, someone will probably still beat me to it and do it better than me.
Yeah. Not only I could start today.
Which has actually happened to me multiple times for real.
Yeah. Like, oh, I really want to do this thing. This sounds like a really cool idea. Okay. Has it ever happened to you where you start doing the thing and then you need to go look up a thing about the thing and someone wrote an article about how to do the sub thing you're talking about in the context of doing the thing that you were trying to do, but mm-hmm. and then you read when the article was posted and it's like a decade ago?
Not exactly like that. I did once upon a time invent a thing and then I looked it up and there was already a patent for it from like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't from 40 years ago. It was from like 15 years ago because the patent wasn't expired yet. So it's like, not only did I come up with this, but it's actually illegal for me to make this.
The next logical thing is, well, the next time I get an idea, the first thing I'm gonna do is go check to see if a patent exists for it. And you can only do that so many times where you're like, I get it, everything's already ever been invented, mm-hmm. there's nothing new under the sun, King Solomon was right, this is a waste of my time. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. No, definitely, that's a mood too. It makes you not want to discuss new ideas. Like it turns you off from the idea of trying
to be
creative.
I've kind of gotten over it. Because doing the stuff is still fun to me. And I at this point I'm at a place where I don't care if somebody else has already done it. I'm going to do it my way because I can.
Yeah. I think that's the cure for that. Honestly, I've been the same way. Like that's literally why
I'm going to prove to myself that I can do it, which is kind of what this article is about.
Well, that's how I feel right now about like, generative AIs in code, right? It's like, yeah, I could just prompt to get me the scaffold for this, but that's not the point. I know I could do that.
I'm an expert. Yeah.
But I'm an expert. I don't need that.
I can do this myself.
Yeah.
I don't need this crutch.
And not only that, but if I take this crutch, I'm just going to get slower at doing it. And then what happens if they take my crutch away? I have regressed.
Right.
And the fear of regressing is what keeps me trying to progress. Because
mm-hmm.
there's also, I think, a good argument to be said where you never truly stand still. You're either regressing or progressing.
Yeah.
And if you're not progressing, you're regressing.
Yeah.
You know? We are running tight on time. I think we should try to wrap
this up. Yes, we should probably try to finish.
So is the next one I have spoken about or...
And so my last piece of advice.
Gotcha. And so my last piece of advice is another perspective from which to view the problem, by which to judge any potential habit of thought you might adopt, and what is to ask.
That is to ask.
And that is to ask. Ah, good. Thank you. And that is to ask, does this way of thinking make me stronger or weaker? Really, truly. I have previously spoken of the danger of reasonableness, the reasonable sounding argument that we should two box on Newcomb's problem, the reasonable sounding arguments that we can't know anything due to the problem of induction, and reasonable sounding argument that we will be better off on average if we always adopt the majority belief, and other such impediments to the way. Capital W on that. Does it win? Is one question you could ask to get an alternative perspective. Another, slightly different perspective is to ask, does this way of thinking make me stronger or weaker? Does constantly reminding yourself to doubt everything make you stronger or weaker? Does never resolving or decreasing those doubts make you stronger or weaker? Does undergoing a deliberate crisis of faith in the face of uncertainty make you stronger or weaker? Does answering every objection with a humble confession of you...
This is a typo.
Yeah. I was going to read it right, too. I was going to self-correct. Does answering every objection with a humble confession of your fallibility make you stronger or weaker? Are your current attempts to compensate for possible overconfidence making you stronger or weaker? Hint. If you are taking more precautions, more scrupulously trying to test yourself, asking friends for advice, working your way up to big things incrementally, or still failing sometimes but less often than you used to, you're probably getting stronger. If you are never failing, avoiding challenges, and feeling generally hopeless and dispirited, you're probably getting weaker. I learned the first form of this rule at a very early age when I was practicing for a certain math test, and found that my score was going down with each practice test I took, and noticed going over the answer sheet that I had been penciling in the correct answers and erasing them. So I said to myself, all right, this time I'm going to use the force and act on instinct. And my score shot up above what it had been in the beginning. And on the real test, it was still higher still. So that was how I learned that doubting yourself does not always make you stronger, especially if it interferes with your ability to be moved by good information, such as your math intuitions. But I did need the test to tell me this. Underconfidence is not a unique sin of rationalists alone, but it is a particular danger into which the attempt to be rational can lead you, and it is a stopping mistake, an error which prevents you from gaining that further experience which could correct the error. Because overconfidence actually does seem quite common amongst aspiring rationalists who I meet, though rather less common among rationalists that have become famous role models. I would indeed name it the third of the three besetting sins of the rationalist.
Interesting.
Very interesting. I, too, have had that experience where I kept changing my mind about the answer and turns out I should have just gone with whatever the first thing that came to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely had that experience.
I've definitely had that experience academically. I can't think of very many examples outside of school where that's happened to me.
Well, for me, going to college was the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I originally thought, I don't feel like this is going to be better. I never really liked school.
Mm.
I liked being smart, but I didn't like doing schoolwork.
Yeah.
Maybe I should just go get a job that I can just go try and fail and be smart about things. But I decided to go to college instead. And, you know, 6 years and tens of thousands of dollars in debt, which could have been worse, later.
And still no degree, by the way.
And still no degree, by the way. Learned very well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn that one the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem.
But yeah, should have just gone with what I originally thought. And I don't know. I feel like, which feels worse? To just do something and get it wrong and be like, ah, well, I was wrong. Or to think about something, change your mind, and then be wrong. It's like, ah, I consider this a lot and was still wrong. Like, I don't know. It's very similar.
You do feel very stupid when that happens.
You feel very, very stupid. And it also makes me kind of, it reminds me of the whole asking for forgiveness as opposed to permission kind of paradox you can, not paradox, but like situation you can find yourself in. Man, I'm a big forgiveness person. I'm just going to do it because...
Yeah, that's why I was saying that I can't think of anything at all off the top of my head outside of academics where that's happened to me. And it's because these days, if something seems like a good idea, I'm keen to just give it a try now.
Why not?
Yeah, the stakes are usually not high enough, right? No.
Yeah, they really aren't.
My life is not going to come crumbling down if I fail. So it's fine. I'll take the risk.
Now, I do think that one situation in which our bias is... well, to reality check us a bit. I do think we happen to be in a fortuitous place where the stakes aren't high. I don't know about you, but I feel very confident that, look, I already have established a comfortable baseline for my life, so any deviation from that, any failure can abort me back to this place. And I'm okay being kicked back. It's like saving at the save checkpoint in a game. You're way more confident right after the checkpoint than you are...
Right. I don't stand to lose very much if I fail. Yeah.
Right. I will backslide to this checkpoint and be like, ah, shoot. Well, let me give it another go. But to those who are still at the starting line and haven't even made it to the first checkpoint yet, it can be, I think, very daunting to act that way and behave that way. And I think also, if you were to think about it, I think in terms of the long game, you know, the closer you get towards the end or the farther you get away from the checkpoint, the more unsettling it gets, but you have to get towards the next checkpoint. And you know, I actually don't think there's that much wrong with thinking about life like that as a series of checkpoints and bounding yourself to move from checkpoint to checkpoint, because I do think the underconfidence is never straying too far from the current checkpoint. Overconfidence is straying too far from the checkpoint and causing a catastrophic kick back to the beginning of the level, you know? Which in life, there are no levels or checkpoints, you know, and outside of the ones,
literal ones, but yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe literal ones in the way of you construct them for yourself. Like, for example, your savings account can be a checkpoint, you know, say you're going to do something risky, like quit your job and try to find a better job. That the checkpoint of, oh, well, I've got savings is a lot nicer than, well, I've got 2 weeks before I miss a paycheck and everything starts crumbling, you know? But even then, they're not true checkpoints. You can't just keep going back to them.
Yeah, I was going to, yeah.
It's more like lives.
The savings account is not really a checkpoint. That's just like a safety net.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's more time. Anyway, do we have a conclusion?
Yeah, I think that this is, once again, another good article. I think I agree more with this one than I do the other. Not to say that I wholeheartedly disagree with the other, but I think this is a lot more pleasant to read and a lot more resonatingly true. And I think just by the fact that it gave us a couple of other things we might want to talk about in the future, definitely a good article. And I think, you know, the lesson of, or that the sin of being underconfident, especially for rationals, and I'm glad he didn't go into it too much in the article, but I think in particular, his examples were all kind of based around this. You know, it can be disheartening to be irrational sometimes because you are confronted consistently with people who, and we talked about this last time, when you're not amongst other rationals, you're surrounded by people who are running on faith, and faith is a powerful drug and can make people extremely confident and extremely bulwarked against rational thought. And it's very easy to be underconfident and be bulldozed by those people, especially in a situation in which it's not just you and them, but there are others in the room and confidence matters. And I think his last minute point about, you know, having this confidence is something you see in the leaders of the group. I think that being confident is an important part of leading a movement. I don't think you can just be confident then become the leader or sorry, I don't think you just become the leader and then therefore are confident. I think it's the other way. You are confident first and then you can affect real change, you know? And I think that's why people look to people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins so much in the rationalist movement, because they were confident. They got on stage. They were wrong in front of people sometimes, but they stepped up and kept doing it, you know, and were a voice. And if you ever want to make an impact of any way or just improve your own life, you know, you kind of have to be that way a little bit, you know. Don't waste too much time being underconfident, I guess.
Fair enough.
Well, until next time, philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.